with over 25 years of experience integrating mental health and spirituality, the author of Reclaiming Authenticity, When Ancestors Weep, and Redeeming the Bereaved. Here is Dr. James Houck.
Okay, well, good afternoon, everybody. I hope your Friday is going along splendidly. So wherever you are in the world at this time, I hope you're having a good day so far. Welcome to Reclaiming Authenticity, finding one's courage to reclaim that which has always, and I mean always, been in you. Very excited to be with you here today, every Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Standard Time. And if you're tuning in for the first time, welcome, welcome. Always enjoy having new listeners, and I'll tell you how to get in touch if you'd like to be part of the show today, a little bit, you know, coming up here. But I'd just like to explain that each and every week, these broadcasts focus on something that's always near and dear to my heart, and that's this integration of spirituality with our mental health. And it just amazes me. Yes, we are all connected, but just how our spirituality and mental health go hand in hand, where we gain insights in one area will often give us insights in the other, and vice versa. And I place this integration of spirituality and mental health all in the context of relationships with ourselves and who we are every time we look into the mirror and what we think about ourselves and so forth. How we interact with others, and our relationship with God or the divine, the universe, and so forth. And, the main reason why I place this integration in relationships is, you know, first of all, we're not an island unto ourselves. As John Donne once said a long time ago, no man or woman is an island. And so we are social creatures, and we have to interact with each other. And, I'm a firm believer that, finding your courage to reclaim that which has always been in you, I also believe that it's within the context of relationships that we often receive our deepest physical, emotional, psychological, and even spiritual wounds. And this is unfortunate, but it's also understandable. However, and this is, these wounds are not the end of our story. But we can discover also in a lot of irony that our greatest healing and strength and peace and forgiveness and love, we can discover, we can embrace, and we can live out those things through healthier relationships. And these relationships, when we think about them, just might be within our own families. Or what about our coworkers? What about our friends? Okay? Because whenever we transform, we also transform others by our presence and our grace and understanding. But first, forgiveness, kindness, and compassion begins with how we treat ourselves. Because, think of it this way. Whenever we are compassionate with ourselves, we can then be compassionate with others. Or when we are more forgiving with ourselves, then perhaps we can be more forgiving of others. And when we are able to live in gratitude with ourselves, I guarantee you, we will then discover how this opens our hearts to see, to embrace, and to live in gratitude with others. Transformation, first and foremost, begins with us. Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and if you would like more information about me or to leave me your comments about today's show, I just invite you to visit the website. It's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. That's www.bbsradio.com/reclaiming authenticity. And just in case you want to go back and listen again, these broadcasts are podcasted. Okay, so you can go back into the archives and listen to previous shows or shows that you may have missed or you want to listen to again. And as I said earlier, if you want to be part of the show, you know, and you like to call in, I invite you to call the toll-free line. It's 888-627-6008. That's 888-627-6008. And give me your insights or comments and thoughts on today's subject. And that is the power of one voice. The power of one voice. Because when you find your own voice and you claim your own voice, it is often compared to as the sound of thunder. It is that powerful. It is that empowering. So the power of one voice. And for those of you, as I said, new to the program, welcome aboard. And I just like to say that I'm a firm believer that all of us already come into the world equipped and graced with everything that we need in this life. And when I say everything that we need, I'm talking about our giftedness, our skills, our talents, our character traits, strengths, personalities, and so forth. However, as we go along in life, and perhaps due to some unpleasant memories or experiences, simply just being in the wrong place at the wrong time, we may feel that we need to hide that talent or those skills or our uniqueness or our giftedness. Or perhaps we push our giftedness way down so that others, you know, cannot see it, because unfortunately, maybe sometime in our life, we feel like we had to live up to somebody's expectations, or what we had shown others was exploited in some way. But you know, it's unfortunate, because when we do that, we do not realize our giftedness. In fact, we don't even understand or have the capacity to yet even embrace all that there is yet to discover about us. And maybe you were told that you would never amount to anything, or, you know, whatever other voice, you know, we heard at some point telling us that there's nothing special to us. And that's just wrong. That is just wrong. And that comes from people who do not understand their own uniqueness, their own, you know, what's special about them, and so forth. Okay. But as I said, at any rate, we do not realize our giftedness in the very best parts of ourselves. And we tend to go through life functioning from a place of woundedness or this place of victimhood, instead of a place of healing or a place of wholeness, or really embracing our hachetas, our uniqueness, as it were. Okay, so again, if you are listening for the very first time, thank you for tuning in and welcome aboard. Well, as I begin with, it seems like every one of these broadcasts each and every week, I have to start off with a question. You know, it's like, what a great way to get on board. Okay, and this is a fun question. Does anybody out there ever remember reading the story, or later perhaps watching the movie, Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who? Yeah, Dr. Seuss's Horton Hears a Who. Okay, it's a classic, obviously. Okay, and if you haven't heard of this story, I just want to just share with you just an overall gist of the story without divulging any spoilers. Okay, but again, if you haven't seen it, you've got to watch the movie. It's, like I said, just a great, great story the whole way through. So anyway, just a general overview. Horton is an elephant, and he just, you know, as all stories begin, once upon a time, was just walking along one day, minding his own business, when all of a sudden he hears a strange sound coming from one of the specks of dust on top of, I would call it, a budding flower. And, you know, this intrigues him. And he listens again, and he hears this sound, you know, just over and over. It's very, very faint, but, you know, he hears it nonetheless. And he learns that this sound is coming from this microscopic town of Whoville. And ironically, he's the only one who hears the people of Whoville. Nobody else can, but he's trying to convince them that, hey, there's people on this speck. There's a whole town there. There's a large amount of people. And everybody just thinks that Horton is crazy or he's lost his mind or like, yeah, okay, Horton, sit down before you fall down kind of thing. Okay. But the people of Whoville are in fear for their lives because they are so small and just perhaps considered insignificant to others. And as a result, Horton then vows to protect this speck, declaring, "A person's a person, no matter how small." And he says that over and over throughout the story. Well, the backstory regarding how the author Dr. Seuss came to write this tale is a fascinating one. It was such a joy that I just did a little research in this area, and it's like, wow, this is a powerful story. It goes like this. During World War II, Theodore Seuss Geisel, otherwise known as Dr. Seuss, was a cartoonist who illustrated some pretty unflattering pictures of the Japanese people. And like I said, this was during World War II, and he came under a lot of scrutiny for these unflattering pictures. However, in 1953, it was Dr. Seuss who visited Japan to research an article for Life magazine. And he wanted to write about the effects of the war and post-war efforts on Japanese children. And so he commissioned the help of, hope I pronounce his name right, Mitsugi Nakamura, Dean of Doshisha University in Kyoto. And with the help of Mr. Nakamura, Dr. Seuss went to schools all over Japan, and he just simply asked kids to draw what they wanted to be when they grew up. Okay, something very simple. I'm sure that we've all drawn these pictures before. Okay, and what Seuss saw made a deep impression on him. And when he returned to America, he started his work on Horton Hears a Who. And it was this book that actually reflects his change of heart about the Japanese people. And this book is dedicated to Nakamura. And there was one interview that Dr. Seuss had done, and he said that Japan was at that time just emerging, and the people were voting for the first time, and they were running their own lives, and this theme was obvious. A person's a person, no matter how small. Okay? And then didn't he went on to say, like, I don't really know why I decided to select an elephant, but you know, hey, it fit. So Horton Hears a Who. Highly recommend it if you've never read the book. Well, this is a prominent theme that emerges time and time again when people not only find the power of their voice, but they also begin listening to the empowerment of others. They too find their voice and they are never the same again. And as I mentioned, it's like the sound of thunder. Okay, it's kind of that attention getting when somebody really steps into their power and how that power is reflected in, as in the throat chakra. And that's very powerful and empowering for a lot of people. And this is often the case with anyone who has gone through any kind of trauma or an event in their life which a person's assumptions have been completely shattered. And to find our voice or to reclaim our voice, it takes time, but it can be done. And a key element in finding your voice and claiming it and using your voice does have an effect on our brain. And the world of science calls this phenomenon brain plasticity or neuroplasticity. In other words, just rewiring the brain. And basically, neuroplasticity allows the neurons or the nerve cells in the brain to compensate for being injured at some point, or let's say they were affected by disease, and to adjust the activities in response to new situations or to changes in the environment. There's actually an old saying in neuroscience that neurons that fire together, are wired together. And this means, the more you run this neural circuit in your brain, the stronger the circuit becomes. And this is also why, to quote another famous saying, practice makes perfect. Because it's not just training your muscles, it's also training your brain or retraining your brain or to think of things differently, to see things just, and adjust your thoughts and your perceptions and so forth. Okay. Well, in really layman's terms, neuroplasticity means that the brain can relearn how to process our senses. It can process what we see. It can reprocess our sounds we hear, tastes and touch and smells and speak. And it can also send signals to muscles so people can walk again or whatever the issue is. And the ability to learn new things and really enhances your existing cognitive capabilities and even helps people recover from strokes and traumatic brain injuries. You said it's very fascinating work, and some of the students that I have talked to, or from other colleges or universities, they've also, those who are involved in more like speech pathology, they find it quite fascinating because they're actually working hands-on with people to, how do you retrain your brain to speak again, or how do you retrain your brain to walk, or even to reach out and pick up an apple or a ball or a pencil. Okay. So they are just thrilled by it. And it's still very much cutting edge technology, even though this has been going on for a while. I think we have yet to see just how much the brain can just rewire itself and to really learn and just help people, again, reclaim parts of themselves that were damaged due to an accident or some sort of disease or illness. Okay. Well, if you have ever seen the movie The King's Speech, again, I recommend this movie. It's just a great movie. It's a fun movie. Okay. The King's Speech, which I believe stars Colin Firth, Helen Bonham Carter, and Jeffrey Rush. And if you're a lover of history, you will love this movie, okay? Because if you've seen it, you may recall that King George VI had a severe speech impediment. In other words, he stuttered. And it was very painful in the opening scenes where before he became king, he was to give a speech. I believe it was at Wembley Stadium. And he just struggled through it. And it was painful to watch him just be tortured through this speech impediment, let alone trying to sit there and listen. Well, through the help of his wife, as the story goes, that he was able to retrain his brain to control his stuttering problem. Okay, and this is where Jeffrey Rush comes in. He was actually an Australian-born theater person. And so, he taught him how to project his voice. He taught him how to slow down and speak, clear, or more clearly, I should say. And perhaps the one part of the scene that, or one part of the movie, the one scene that I really connected with is when they were just talking one day, just the king and Jeffrey Rush's character, about childhood trauma. And he just realized that he not only had stomach problems because he wasn't being fed by one of his nannies and just a lot of painful experiences that he really had to stifle his voice, and just lived in a lot of fear. And he just didn't see himself as being empowered. But whenever he started to get in touch with this started to open up his voice, and he started to retrain himself as to, how to speak properly. And again, it was just, practice makes perfect. But this is one of the ways in which the brain can retrain itself, that the brain can actually heal from especially something very traumatic in childhood. Well, brain plasticity has certainly come a long, long way, and it's just fascinating the amount of research that's been done in this area, because it has given hope to millions of people. And just a couple of examples here, like for parents of special needs children, plasticity has demonstrated how we can use speech and language therapy to improve communication, as well as curb the behavioral challenges that perhaps come with special needs children. And fascinating work. It just gives the kids a sense of control, as well as hope for the parents. And very easy to reinforce. And it's just a matter of, you know, practice makes perfect. And musicians can also illustrate, you know, this experience-dependent neuroplasticity, if you will, that whenever we learn to play an instrument, you know, we are involving our left brain and right brain simultaneously. Or, again, in science, it's called left brain, right brain synchronicity. And music therapy is an excellent way for people to rewire their brain activity, especially when it comes to reading and playing music at the same time. And when you sing music as well, you're using that left brain, right brain activity. And again, for people with a speech impediment or relearning to speak all over again, they often find a great success in singing. And it's just something about the music, the tunes that go along with the lyrics, to be able to sing, that just gives a nice flow to the language. Okay, so it's just great, great success in just music therapy. Well, another good example of neuroplasticity is learning a new language. Okay, so when someone is learning a new language, the neurons that are responsible for language often connect with the sounds of the language, or recognizing pictures associated with the language itself. So for those of you out there who are fans of Rosetta Stone or other language programs that integrate sights and sounds with prominent nouns and verbs and common phrases, you know, these things are often learned more easily than just sound repetition alone. And of course, you know, if you know a second language or a third or fourth language, you know that the best form of learning a language is a total immersion, just being immersed in a new culture. And you're learning not just the dialect of the language and not just the words, but you are immersed in the culture. You're immersed in that context. Okay. And other examples of neuroplasticity often include, you know, traveling or exploring new places, or creating art or other creative pursuits, writing poetry or whatever else, and reading and getting plenty of rest. And of course, diet and exercise, you know, and there's more to diet and exercise than just losing weight. But it all supports healthy brain activity. Of course, it increases blood flow and, you know, releases endorphins when we're exercising and things like that. It's all very, very good. Okay, so let's, you know, just take a few moments. Let's go back in time here, and let's just, you know, take a look at how brain plasticity works. Okay, and this is something that, again, it's ingrained in us. We come into the world with this capacity, this capability from day one. Okay, and because, you know, between the ages of 1 and about 3 years old, our brains are just, you know, just rapidly expanding its neurons and its synapses, or the spaces, the microscopic spaces between the neurons. And by age 1, according to the experts, they say that we have about 2,500 synapses, okay, which is pretty impressive by age 1. But by age 3, they say we have about 15,000 synapses, okay? So, of course, learning language and brain production and cognitive skills are just taken off within the first 3 years of our lives. So all the more reason for those of you who have little children out there, babies, infants, toddlers, and the like, to read and to discuss and to pursue other like creative arts or allowing them to draw or something, and just have these conversations with your children, because they are little sponges and they are picking up everything, but their cognitive skills are just making leaps and bounds. Now, it's interesting that even though by age three, we have about 15,000 synapses, that is the space between these neurons, but again, experts come in and they say, yeah, but as we age, we have about half that number. So are we just talking about an aging brain, or what is it? But they say that, the reason why, as we get older, we have about half of those synapses is because as we gain new experiences, some of these connections that we have are strengthened and some are eliminated. And they call this process synaptic pruning, okay, where the neurons that are used frequently, develop stronger connections, of course. And those that are rarely or never used, they eventually die, okay? But the brain is able to rewire itself as well. So by developing new connections and pruning away weak ones, just to turn a phrase, the brain is able to adapt to the changing environment. And this was something that Swiss psychologist Jean Piaget stated, that we can adapt to new challenges in our world because we are well equipped to learn. And perhaps you've heard of Piaget, but he's best known for his constructivist theory, which suggests that people actively construct their knowledge of the world based on the interactions between their ideas and their experiences. And he really developed this theory a little bit more through what he would call assimilation and accommodation. And this is something that we never lose as we get older. It begins in childhood, of course, because, we need to learn about our worlds. We need to learn new information, okay? And once we have learned something, let's say, something in childhood, we learn how to tie our shoes, or we learn how to go to the bathroom, okay, ourselves. We learn how to dress ourselves, okay? This is new information. And so this is this assimilation, that we just include this new knowledge and this skill into our brains. However, let's say that you are well-skilled in tying your shoes, but what do you do then when you come across a pair of shoes that do not have laces? Okay, you're a little kid, and all of you, you're proud of yourself because you learned how to tie your shoes, but what's this? Your shoes don't come with any laces. So what do you do? So Piaget would say that, this is something where we just take those existing cognitive schemes of, I don't even know how to tie a shoe. But we just slide our foot into the shoe, maybe with a shoehorn, we can just slide it in anyway. But then once we've learned something new, then we accommodate. Okay, and it's not that we so-called dismiss what we have already learned, but we're now allowing more room in our brains to take on even more information. Okay, so there is a classic example out there of, let's say, a magnet. Okay, and for little kids, they're fascinated with magnets. They just don't know what to do with it. So depending on their age, it's going to go in their mouth, right, as everything else did. They're going to taste it, they're going to smell it, they're going to throw it. They have no idea what a magnet is used for, okay? But they're trying to figure it out with the knowledge that they already have, okay? Which is everything is through the senses, especially the mouth, okay? Well, once they realize that they've scared their mothers half to death by putting a magnet in their mouth and start swishing it around, and mom goes in there and just grabs it out of their little jaws, they wipe it off, and then mom shows them the proper use for magnets, Okay. And it's like you can hang stuff up. But again, the properties of the magnet is the magnet will only stick to metal. But then eventually the kid figures it out, just like we all did. Okay. And then this what leads little kids to become very good at refrigerator art. And they're making all kinds of drawings and paintings. And here, Mom, you know, put this on the refrigerator. And they grab a little magnet. Boom. There it goes. Very, you know, just a classic example of this assimilation accommodation. And so this, as I said, Jean Piaget was just fascinated of how we are able to increase not just knowledge, but how our minds cognitively develop and just allow for new information. So Piaget stated, we can adapt to new challenges in our world because we are well equipped to learn. Okay. Well, I'd really like to hear your heart on this subject and mind. Okay. So if you would like to call in, the number is 888-627-6008. And I'll be taking your calls after the break. Again, you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. And I am your host, Dr. James Houck. And I'll be back with you in 1 minute. Okay, well, welcome back. I am Dr. James Houck, and you are listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. Again, before we pick up where we left off with brain plasticity and finding the power of our voice, I just want to say a word about next week's show, entitled it The Spirit of Mountains. The Spirit of Mountains. And again, a lot of people, you know, thousands and thousands of people are fascinated by mountains, you know, and they're just awestruck at times through their beauty and majesty. And a lot of people climb mountains. They enjoy hiking through mountains and camping in mountains and so forth. And it's just amazing how connected, or how much, I should say, we can find our connection to mountains. So that's going to be a theme that's going to run throughout next week's show. So I invite you to tune in next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time. Well, early in the show, we were talking about neuroplasticity, or the brain's ability to heal or relearn new ways of carrying out normal functions that, let's say, have been interrupted by trauma or disease. And I had mentioned that, you know, there's an old saying that neurons that fire together, you know, can do this because they are wired together. And this means that the more you run your neurons and this neural circuit, as you will, in your brain, the stronger that circuit becomes. And this is where we get the practice makes perfect. Okay, and so all in all, it just means that the brain can relearn how to process sights and sounds and tastes and touch and smells and how we talk and so forth. And it also sends signals to our muscles to tell us to move or to walk or to regain balance or whatever it might be. Okay, so we'll recommend another book here because in the second half of this show, I really want to talk about how, in finding our voice, how can we really emphasize neuroplasticity. How can we simply create changes in our brain by discovering our voice? Well, there's a great book out there. Again, if you haven't read it, I highly recommend it. It's called Buddha's Brain by Rick Hansen. It came out several years ago, Buddha's Brain. And Rick Hansen takes a look at, or I should say he combines the insights that he gained from, say, neuroscience with just looking at contemplative practices or mindfulness practices. And the theme that runs through this book is that how you can use your mind to shape your brain in terms of, you know, greater happiness or love and wisdom. And this book that he wrote, Buddha's Brain, it actually draws on the latest research, and it shows people how to stimulate your brain for more fulfilling relationships or a deeper spiritual life. And so it does a nice job in just wedding together contemplative practices and neuroscience. And, you know, certainly any kind of, you know, quiet meditation, contemplation, chanting, and so forth has the potential of rewiring the brain. And interestingly, when I deal with clients, we often talk about contemplation and meditation because a lot of them are anxious and a lot of them just want to feel better, which is not a bad place to begin. But in just slowing down the brain and slowing down the anxious thoughts or the heightened anxiety or their, you know, panic symptoms, you know, just by sitting with themselves and slowing their thoughts and focusing on deep breathing or, you know, simple chanting or something actually has been shown to rewire the brain. And you can, as I explain to clients, especially kids, like, yeah, we can teach our, or we can reteach our brains, you know, in order to heal their stinking thinking. Okay, where a lot of kids just would get into this, well, I can't do anything right, or, you know, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not smart enough, I'm not handsome enough, I'm not strong enough. And we make a list of all their stinking thinking definitions or their perspectives. And, of course, giving them homework assignments because, well, that's what I do. And these kids are very gracious. But they are just fascinated how, you know, just sitting with their thoughts and focusing on how they can change their thoughts, you know, just not only begins to send, you know, changes to their brain and rewire their brain, even if they don't know everything there is to know about the mechanics of the brain, but they actually start to feel better. They actually start to have more confidence in what they can do, and they actually get in touch with who they truly are, and not so much having to rely on somebody else's definition of who they think they need to be just in order to satisfy somebody else, you know, some authority figure in their life or parents or whatever. But we also talk about that too, that, you know, there's a lot of stinking thinking out there in the world, and we have to be able to, you know, kind of sort through all this, if you will, or sift through it in order to, you know, what really resonates within us, what connects with us, and what are some things that really bring us down and things that just are no good. And the best thing we can do is just to get rid of them. Okay. Well, as I mentioned before the break, Jean Piaget, Swiss psychologist, was known for his assimilation and accommodation. But there's also other learning theorists out there, you know, and I'm thinking of one of my favorite learning theorists, and that's Albert Bandura. And, you know, like Jean Piaget looked at, you know, cognitive development, Albert Bandura looked at, you know, just behaviors and as well as the mind. But his was more of, you know, how do we learn? And who are, you know, who are these people in our lives that teach us these lessons and so forth. And his quote that I love and I use whenever I can is, "Lessons learned as children are not easily unlearned as adults." I'll say it again. Lessons learned as children are not easily unlearned as adults. Okay, he's not saying that it's impossible. Okay, that's not what he's saying. But what he's saying is it's going to take time. And it isn't necessarily all negative lessons. You know, we just want to go there and say, well, as a kid, I learned this, or I was always taught that about myself or about something else or other perceptions in society that are just not really life-giving. And so, again, those messages as we're growing up are just, are not life-giving to us. And we're just like, okay, we need to get rid of those, or we need to unlearn those messages. Okay, not impossible, but it will take time. But on the other side of this is, you know, the positive lessons that we have been taught. Like, let's say a strong work ethic. And, you know, perhaps, just watching parents who've had a strong work ethic and, you know, or how to value money and how to manage money or their time or something, those lessons are not easily unlearned as adults. They stay with us. And if these lessons are life-giving to us, of course, we're going to keep them. Okay, because at that point it's become habit. And we know that when things become habit after a while, it's going to be part of our character. It's going to shape us to a certain degree. And there's other theories out there that focus also on the human voice and just the power of the human voice and the changes that it makes on our brains and actually rewires our perspectives. And I'm thinking about narrative therapy. And narrative therapy, in a nutshell, is pretty much giving a person the time and the space to tell their story without any judgments, without any values attached to them, like, well, that was a long story, or, yeah, I don't know if I like that story. Well, it doesn't matter if you like it or not. It's the person's story. Okay, but it's something that needs to be shared, or as I like to say, that every life is a story worth telling, and every story worth telling is worth listening to. Okay, so narrative therapy is very, very popular and just also very empowering. I mean, because think about it. In your own life, when have you ever been encouraged to tell your story? Okay, or whenever in your life were you allowed to tell your story, and the freedom that that gave you, perhaps in, you know, at a time in which you weren't given that permission, but, you know, let's say now you are given that permission, and you just, you know, there's a lot to share there, okay, as well as either pain or something that was life-giving or whatever it is, it's your story, okay, but given that permission or that access to be able to tell that story in different ways, that's very life-giving. It's very empowering. And again, it's how we use our voice. Or perhaps other people may find ways in which they tell their stories through painting or writing a book or music or something. Okay? Again, all of that is part of brain plasticity. Okay, it may be very, very subtle, but we are retraining our brains to tell our stories, perhaps in healthier ways. And this is something that, you know, again, by listening to ourselves, and I also highly recommend that you tape yourselves telling a story, because there's so much more about telling our stories than just the words that we choose. But it also depends on how we tell the story. Okay, what emotions are invoked in us? What feelings come up? What are things that we leave out because we think they're insignificant or they're just not part of our memory? What things have we gone through? What lessons have we learned? Where are we still stuck? And so forth. And perhaps more importantly, how does our family tell stories? Okay. I know I've shared many times on this broadcast that I was probably about 8, 9, 10, 11 years old, something like that. And I've heard my family stories over and over and over again to the point of nauseam. Okay. That I was able to tell those stories without a script. I could just like, boom, there, let me tell you a story. What happened way back when? But I caught myself one day telling stories the way my father told stories or my grandmother told stories. And they told from a very unique perspective, but yet it also had a lot of emotion tied to it. And I found that I was getting caught up in those emotions as well. Okay. And it was affecting me. But when I was able to, and this is many, many, many years later, I was able to take a step back and just like, why am I telling the stories from this perspective with such emotions and the specific emotions in general? Okay. But when I looked at that and I started to heal because I looked at some of the issues in my life, I also realized that I started to tell those stories differently because, you know, unbeknownst to me at the time, I was rewiring my brain. My perceptions had changed. I was telling stories now from a much healthier place, not from a place of pain and suffering and woundedness, but it was empowering. And it was from a place of simple reflection of, yes, these things happened. This is how other people looked at them, but these stories do not sum up the end-all, be-all of who I am. And the same thing is true in your own family's lives. You know, the stories that you have learned over time just because you listen to them doesn't sum up the end-all, be-all of who you are. In other words, you're still writing that narrative. You still have a story to tell. It is still going on. Well, I also want to share with you just a powerful way in which how we can change our perspectives and how we can rewire our brain just by discovering our voice and how we heal and how that just creates significant, significant changes into who we think we are versus who we really are. Okay. And the example that for me is just so classic, and I share this with my clients all the time for those who are struggling with this. And it's these underlying core messages that are found in addictions. Underlying core messages. It doesn't really matter what the addiction is. It could be a gambling addiction. It could be overeating addiction. It could be a sex addiction. It could be alcoholism. It could be, you know, some form of substance abuse addiction or whatever it is. Okay. But there's these underlying core messages that are just common and can be found in, and I believe, any addictions, which is key to not only taking away its power, but also rewiring our brain as we find our voice, as we share our voice, as we reclaim that power that is ours because we came into the world with that already. So here's the first core belief, okay? Again, remember, put this into the context of addictions, okay? First core belief, well, I'm basically a bad, unworthy person. Okay, I'm basically a bad, unworthy person. And just you hear that. You hear the language and the feelings of shame and guilt, especially shame, okay, where there's a lot of feelings of inadequacy or failure, or maybe there were experiences of humiliation or degradation, you know, or a lot of times with addictions, there's this, you know, this secret that needs to be upheld of, you know, you have to hide, you know, who you are because you're so filled with unworthiness. And so when you say I'm basically a bad, unworthy person, you're pretty much saying, you know, people wouldn't really like me if they knew deep down inside who I am. Okay, not what I do, but who I am. And so that carries with it this shame language. But as I said, transformation can occur. And here's the transformation thought, or the voice. I am worthwhile. I am a worthwhile person. And I do deserve pride. I'm a worthwhile person and deserving of pride. And that is very empowering. I mean, you talk about reclaiming who you are. You realize your value and dignity and worth, and how the addiction has robbed that, or how you've surrendered that perhaps to the addiction and this role of secrecy in it. Okay. Well, the core belief number two is no one would love me as I am. In other words, everybody would abandon me if the truth were known. Or, to put it another way, everything that goes wrong is somehow my fault. You know, the person spends an enormous amount of time and energy creating this image of being in charge of life and no need of help, should say. Okay. And significant persons who want to draw close to the one who is addicted, they start to feel pushed away or useless or neglected. You know, but it just comes from this self-loathing language, and you can hear the shame that is just permeating this core belief that no one would love me as I am. However, the transformation comes in and pretty much says, well, I am loved and I am accepted by people who know me as I am. I am loved and accepted by people who know me as I am. And you can just hear the empowerment in that transformation. Again, taking back who you really are. Okay, but in the world of addictions, there's this secrecy, there's this self-loathing and a lot of shame. Okay, that nobody understands me if they really knew me. But that's why I do the drugs or whatever it is, so I can feel better. Problem is, it's a black hole that can never be filled up because of this emptiness inside. However, when a person is able to transform their thoughts, transform their speech, you are retraining your brain to say, no, I'm loved and I am accepted by people who know me as I am. Okay. Well, core belief number three is that my needs are never going to be met if I have to depend on somebody else. My needs are never going to be met if I have to depend on somebody else. And this person is caught up in an addiction because perhaps they feel unloved or unlovable. And a lot of anger and rage and, you know, internalized resentment or self-pity, maybe suicide ideation, depression. Okay. But there's really, when you boil it all down, there's just, they have no confidence that others will love them. And that, you know, these kinds of rules of being worthy and being accepted only apply to the people who are lovable. Okay. But these people often get by from being, you know, calculating or manipulative or ruthless. But it all comes back to, I really can't depend upon anybody else. Okay. Or, you know, here's a classic line that if you want something done right, you're going to have to do it yourself. But the transformation comes in when it says, my needs can be met by others if I let them know what I need. Okay. And then the last one, you know, whatever the addiction is, sex, drugs, alcohol, whatever it is, that is my most important need. And again, it's just this empty, vicious cycle where a lot of cover-up lies and deceptions are made to conceal this kind of behavior. Okay, but the transformation comes in and says, well, I have many healthy expressions of my need and care for others. So in just looking at these core beliefs in the, you know, the context of addictions and how to change, not only, you know, how we heal from, you know, and be able to have healthier perceptions about ourselves, but also claiming and reclaiming our voice really rewires our brain to begin to see ourselves in much healthier ways and to be in much healthier relationships. And a kind of interesting thing, and I'll leave you with this, is that all these transformative statements certainly apply to our relationship with God. Because who knows us better than we know ourselves, but yet loves us unconditionally? Well, I'm Dr. James Houck, and you have been listening to Reclaiming Authenticity. I have enjoyed this hour with you. That goes by fast. But tune in next Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, noon Pacific Time. And until then, take care and God bless.
For an answer, or just to leave 1,000 comments, or prodding to buy a book by Dr. Houck, it's all there. Just wander on over to ReclaimingAuthenticity.com and click around. And we'll see you next Friday at noon Pacific Time on PBS Radio TV.